Welcome to The River Trip, a monthly program here on KSJD. I'm your trip leader, Leanne Hill. I'm the program coordinator for Dolores River Boating Advocates, a local group of whitewater boaters who are committed to protecting the unique recreation and conservation values of the Dolores River. You can learn more about us on our website at www.dolorisriverboating.org. And today, I am honored to have Jack Loeffler on our river trip. Jack is an author, producer, sound collage artist, a bioregional aural historian, and a scholar of bioregionalism. Jack is a board member of Lore of the Land, which is an organization that nurtures bioregional documentation within indigenous and traditional communities of the Greater Southwest to support an ongoing self-directed oral history program that is instrumental in maintaining languages, environments, and lifeways. Jack's been involved with many books and projects, which you can learn about in his bio at Lore of the Land website. It's www.loreoftheland.org. Thanks for joining us this morning, Jack.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your program, Leanne. This is great.
It is great, and we have a lot I'd like to cover today and a short time to do it, so this will be more like speed boating rather than floating.
Gotcha.
In 2012, you and your daughter, Celestia, published a book called Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices from the West, which is a compilation of your own thoughts and thoughts of other great bioregional thinkers about how we live in place and how we live in our place and our own watersheds in particular. Can you explain what thinking like a watershed means?
Well, what it means to me is you take the metaphor, basically, of what a watershed is, and then you try to put your mind in the middle of it. Watershed is a pretty definable area, like the Dolores River watershed or the San Juan River watershed. You can see a watershed by looking at the ridge tops in the region and realize that all of the water in that region is basically draining toward the main stem of a region. In other words, you look at the Grand Canyon, it's very obvious about that. But thinking like a watershed is a lot more complex than just thinking about water within the context of the watershed, because it involves the entire biotic community within the geophysical cradle and the interactions between all the fellow critters, be they molecules, practically, little cells, all the way up to the human species, which over the last couple hundred thousand years has gradually become the keystone species on the planet. And so when I think like a watershed, I try to think of myself within the context of my homeland, thinking in terms of bioregionalism within the homeland, which means looking at all of the interrelationships between the biotic community within the context of the geophysical cradle and seeing how those interrelationships are constantly in motion, never stopping, never ceasing. And that's what it means to me to think like a watershed. It's kind of a big thought, and to me it's a metaphor for human consciousness, really imagining how we as a species fit within the context of homeland and extending from that what our moral or ethical obligations are to that homeland.
And that's a concept that I think you have found many thinkers and highlighted them in your book. Of course, John Wesley Powell is one who was thinking like a watershed. Can you explain his persuasions and, tell us a little bit about his work in that realm?
Well, John Wesley Powell, who's one of my great heroes, after the Civil War ended in 1865, Powell actually headed out west and explored much of the West from horseback and also running the occasional river. He was the first with his party to descend the Grand Canyon, and as far as we know. But at any rate, Powell recognized that west of the 100th meridian is a wholly arid habitat, totally dissimilar to what lies east of the 100th meridian, where there's a lot of rain and it's verdant, green, and wondrous from the point of view of growing things. But he realized that with the advent of manifest destiny, which basically cleared the way, in other words, defeating a lot of Native American people, Indian tribes, and putting them on reservations to clear the land for westward development, basically, so entrepreneurs could move westward and turn habitat into money, Powell recognized that the West was way too arid to inhabit by Eastern standards. There is not that much rain out here. There's not that much precipitation. It's a dry land. And so he forwarded the notion after he'd become the second director of the United States Geological Survey. He forwarded the notion before the Congress of the United States between 1888 and 1890 that the West actually be looked at watershed by watershed, and that each of these watersheds in the American West would be a commonwealth, and that the human inhabitants in each of these commonwealth watersheds would basically govern the watersheds from within. His idea was to try to make people conscious of the limitations of the landscape into which they would be moving from the verdant east. And so he thought that it was absolutely vital that people understand the nature of each of the watersheds that they'd be moving into, and that they would be governing the watersheds from within, governing the use of the waters, the timber in the watersheds, the grasslands, or whatever it was. In other words, how to comport themselves appropriately within their watershed, their home watershed. Congress shot them down, and suddenly the hodgepodge of geopolitical boundaries that we have today, the state lines, became what we are living in today. Now, had Powell's concept gone through, I'm sure that there would be infinitely more awareness about between people and homeland. People would really have a much better idea as to the nature of homeland. And from my perspective, Powell's idea from governance from within the watershed makes a heck of a lot more sense than having been governed from on high, from Washington, D.C., where so few people have any real idea as to the relationship of human culture to the biotic community. So at any rate, that's why I think that Powell's map, which reflects these beautiful renderings of the watersheds in different colors, gives a real inkling as to how human culture can live successfully within the context of homeland by looking at the watersheds where we all live.
And this watershed concept brings us to the, and everything you have just discussed, brings us to the carrying capacity of a watershed, which I think we're really struggling with now. Can you explain the carrying capacity of a watershed to us?
Well, it's one of the great writers from the 20th century was a man named Garrett Hardin, who'd written a wonderful essay, not a very happy one, called The Tragedy of the Commons, where Hardin took an example from Great Britain from 200 or 300 or 400 years ago, where there was a commons. In other words, there was a common pasture land. People living around the pasture land were putting their cattle and sheep and everything into these commons. And it was apparent after a while that you put too many cattle or sheep in the commons, the ecosystem itself is going to crash. And what Garrett Hardin called the tragedy of the commons was based on the fact that it was like a Greek tragedy, that everybody knew that by putting too many more pigs, cattle, sheep in the commons, that it would crash. But they did it anyway, and indeed, the commons crashed. And so he was talking about human settlement of an area, and it cannot exceed the carrying capacity of the biotic community. In other words, the human population, when it grows too great, is going to exceed the carrying capacity of that area, and away it goes. It'll crash. In other words, the ecosystem won't function properly. Things will go awry, as we've seen happen an awful lot in different parts of the Colorado River watershed and other watersheds around the West. Now, looking at, say, the Colorado River watershed from 1900, where the human population of California was more than or less than one-tenth of its current population, people began to think in terms of plumbing the Colorado River, the lower parts of the Colorado River, in order, in anticipation of an onslaught or a wave of people moving in. And indeed, the human population of California has gone from about 3 million in 1900 to now over 38 million, an awful lot of those people, over 25 million, being located in Southern California. Well, basically, the carrying capacity of that habitat has been exceeded and exceeded and exceeded, so that the biotic community throughout that region has just been cast asunder. It isn't totally dead, but the ecosystem has not been given all of the thought that it should have been given. Basically, what's happened in those days, Sam P. Hayes, who was an historian of the Industrial Revolution, pointed out that in American culture, we were motivated by the gospel of efficiency, which was totally anthropocentrically oriented. In other words, everything we were thinking about was for us as the human, not even species, human beings, human cultures. We had ceased to recognize that we are an animal species in the main. And subsequently, when we plumbed the Colorado River back after 1922, what happened was is we really gave no regard to the rest of the biotic community. The water was all taken away from the river so that today barely a drop gets to the Sea of Cortez. People are working on trying to restore the Sea of Cortez that way. But the upshot is that we exceeded the carrying capacity of the biotic community within that region, and subsequently the biotic community has suffered enormously. Now, we're looking at a time in the American Southwest especially where global warming and climate instability seem to be resulting in far less precipitation, especially during the winter months, and snowpack is being less, it is revealed to be far less than it normally has been. So that means that during the spring thaws, there will be less water coming down the rivers, which means that the human population, in conjunction with the rest of the biotic communities within these particular watersheds, are really going to feel the pain of having less water to deal with. In other words, we have created cultural lifestyles within the context of our watersheds that have exceeded the carrying capacity of the watersheds themselves to support us. The main element here is water itself. Without water, nothing can survive. No living creature can survive without water. And that's one of the things that we have to really attend to, and especially in this coming time. I would recommend everybody reading my friend Bill DeBuise's excellent book, A Great Aridness, because it really defines what is happening in the American Southwest and what happens when the carrying capacity of any watershed has been exceeded, especially in a time of extended drought.
Jack,
does that make sense at all?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's very timely. We have plenty going on right here in the Dolores Basin that relates directly to that, and I so appreciate your joining us today to discuss this. We're going to take a very quick station break, and we'll be back to hear some more from Jack, and I hope you can share a passage from your book with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back to The River Trip on KSJD. I'm joined by Jack Loeffler, who is speaking with us about thinking like a watershed. Jack, can you share a passage from your book with us? I mean, you cover a lot, and as your informants cover a lot, so I think it'd be hard for me to choose one, but I hope you can.
Well, I'm going to read a little bit from right near the end of the book. Basically, one of the things I should say is that I believe that indigenous cultures, Native American peoples who have lived in these various regions for many, many years, centuries, even millennia, have a real handle on how to survive within the context of habitat. And so that's much of what this book is about. I'm going to read you a short passage from near the end of the book, and interrupt me if I'm going on too long here. Okay, from the end of the book, this is what I wrote near the conclusion. Traditional indigenous cultures and other cultures that have evolved long-term sustainability within specific habitats retain the adaptability to shifting conditions, including resilience within the inevitability of change. The native cultures of the North American Southwest still retain strong traditional practices that align themselves with the flow of nature. Their sense of place is enduring, and they have much to teach the rest of us about recognition of our kinship with fellow species, rootedness within the biotic community, and the sacred nature of life, consciousness, and homeland. In the most real sense, the indigenous nations and communities of the North American Southwest are seed pods of human survival potential over the coming century. We should heed their wisdom and learn to respect their intuitive understanding of relationship of culture to homeland. Indeed, people of the land point the way to the practice of restoration ecology in home habitat, and concurrently, our cultural restoration as we re-engage with the land. To de-secularize the landscape is a profound concept that we would do well to enshrine as the epitome of a land ethic. Tithing habitats for protection within each ecosystem might ensure survival of biological diversity as we understand it. To resurrect handcrafted lifestyles, as revealed in many of the chapters in this anthology, may lead the way out of the spiritual lethargy of consumerism into lives filled with meaning. Consciousness is nature's enormous gift to our species as we have evolved over scores of millennia. How we use this gift of consciousness will determine how our role either develops or decays over the coming decades. Reveling in the flow of nature leads to a level of spiritual awareness available nowhere else. Fully engaging the five bodily senses in wildlands is to reawaken lost sensibilities and redefine perspective. Looking deep into the heart of our galaxy of a summer nighttime while listening to coyotes sing allows a glimpse into just how profound the gift of consciousness is. There is tremendous consciousness to be gleaned from deep perception of home watershed. To think like a watershed requires the evolved capacity to perceive interconnectedness in motion. To understand the watershed food shed as commons requires the consciousness of the absolute egalitarian. In consciousness, we trust.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for joining us today and planting those seeds of consciousness. And I think you've offered us some great food for thought as we wrestle with things like trans mountain diversions and other topics that seem to reemerge in our watersheds.
Just say one quickie here.
Please.
John Wesley Powell was adamantly against interbasin transfers of water because they create a false sense of security within the context of the watershed.
Yeah, I think it's a big situation that we really need to think about deeply. I think about the biotic community that you've been discussing and how important that is and how our anthropomorphic viewpoint doesn't really benefit us.
No, it doesn't at all.
I do thank you for joining us today, Jack, and I hope folks have a chance to look into your work, the latest being Thinking Like a Watershed. You can find it at your local bookstore. It's a great and thought-provoking read. You can also find out more about Jack's work at Lore of the Land at www.loreoftheland.org. Please tune in next month on Thursday, April 10th at 8:30 on KSJD for the next edition of The River Trip. And to learn more about Dolores River boating advocates and issues involving the Dolores River, please visit our website at www.doloresriverboating.org. Thanks for tuning in today and see you on the river.